The Life of Jesus by Brother Melvin Perkis. Book 7, Chapter 6. By what authority? The third day of Passover week marked the end of Christ's public work. It was a day full of incidents, and when it was over, Jesus had left the temple for the last time. The atmosphere, already tense and expectant, was mounting with each passing hour. It was on his way back from Bethany this Tuesday morning that the disciples had been startled by the withered fig tree and had received their lesson on the power of faith. The little company continued the journey into Jerusalem and proceeded to the temple, where Jesus began once more to teach, but not for long. He was quickly interrupted. Yesterday the Pharisees and Sadducees had watched him in impotent rage as he had for the second time cleansed the temple. They would dearly have loved to send the officers to arrest him. But a measure that had failed palpably on the previous occasion was even more likely to fail now. Nor had they been able to oppose him themselves. Their personal courage was totally inadequate to withstand his moral and spiritual strength. They could only stand aside in awe as he swept through them with unapproachable majesty. During the hours of darkness, they marshalled their forces. Scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, bitter enemies in so many phases of life and thought, combined in an unholy alliance against him. They drew near now, united in their single determination to destroy him. There were two ways open to them. Either they could break his power over the people and thus safely take him, or they could lure him into making some obviously seditious statements which would make his arrest inevitable. They had carefully chosen their spokesmen, men versed in the laws of polemics and skilled in the cut and thrust of controversy. It was a planned campaign, each issue subtly designed to entrap powerful reserves waiting to be thrown into the conflict in the event of failure. To many a pilgrim who saw Jesus for the first time, the scene must have presented an incongruous contrast, as the lordly aristocrats of the temple, resplendent in their official garments, bore down upon the quiet figure in his homespun robe. The exchanges could surely have but one ending. It was altogether too one-sided. What chance of survival had the Galilean against the prestige and wisdom represented here? But there were many who knew better and waited eagerly for the attack. By what authority doest thou these things? And who gave thee this authority to do these things? It was a strong opening. After the cleansing of the temple at the outset of his ministry, this question had been, "What sign showest thou unto us, seeing thou doest these things?" For 3 years the Messiah had given them abundant signs of his authority, but they had been willfully blind. Now they did not ask for signs, but for authority. A rabbi was not entitled to teach without the consent of the Sanhedrin. Indeed, there was a form of ordination by which a teacher, having first been steeped in the tradition of the elders, was recruited into the service of the temple and synagogue as a scribe and rabbi. No such consent had been obtained by Christ. Yet, not only had he taught openly in the temple, but he had criticized its ministers and abused its practices. Jesus met this searching question with another, promising to answer theirs when they had answered his. Yet his question was in effect both an answer to theirs and an exposure of their crafty motive. "The baptism of John, was it from heaven or of men? Answer me." In appealing to John, Christ appealed to one whom all men accounted a prophet, to one, moreover, whose whole mission was to reveal the identity of Jesus as the Christ. Here was indeed the authority for his work. Jesus challenged them to state their views on the prophet's message. To acknowledge John was to acknowledge Christ. This they obviously were not prepared to do. Yet to condemn the ministry of John was equally impossible in view of the unshakable conviction of the people concerning him. Their only escape lay in an abject confession of their ignorance, a confession which could have deceived nobody, and only emphasized the decisiveness of their defeat. "Neither," said Jesus, "do I tell you by what authority I do these things." Pressing home the victory he had so easily won from this imposing attack, Jesus, by a series of parables, demonstrated to them their neglect of the charge God had committed to them and their ingratitude to him for the privileges they enjoyed. A certain man who had two sons asked the first to go and work in his vineyard. He refused, but later he repented and went. When the second was similarly instructed, he promised willingly enough, but did not go. It was a simple story, and there was only one answer to the question Jesus put to his accusers: whether of them twain did the will of his father? "The first," they answered shortly. "Verily I say unto you," replied Jesus, looking with sadness rather than anger upon the group of ecclesiastics around him, "the publicans and the harlots go into the kingdom of God before you." The people crowding round him looked horrified. The rulers drew in their breath sharply and turned pale with anger. Their eyes changed from hostility to hatred. Yet Jesus spoke only the truth. The Jews were divided into those who sought righteousness by the law and those who completely ignored the demands of God. When true righteousness was revealed from heaven in the person of Christ, it was the moral and spiritual outcasts who recognized and received it. The ministers of ceremonial righteousness had found so much personal satisfaction in the dignity and power which their office brought that they rejected the righteousness which is by faith. For the first time, Jesus confronted his enemies with the fact of their conspiracy against his life. In the parable of the wicked husbandman, he showed them this coming rejection in the wider perspective of the purpose of God. He came as the Son of God, in direct line with the prophets sent by his Father to his people down the centuries, seeking the legitimate fruits of his vineyard. In the true character of their faithless ancestors, the present husbandmen were in no mood to reverence the Son. As long as they could pay lip service to God and enjoy the fruits of the vineyard themselves, they were content. Any attempt to change these favourable conditions from whatever source it might come must be effectively suppressed. This man had come with formidable claims. He had done many wonderful works, but he was contesting their power and authority. He must go. They had made Beelzebub serve their purpose in dismissing his miracles. It remained now for them to break his hold over the people and put him out of the way. Such was the power of Christ's teaching that as he unfolded the parable to them, they were visibly impressed. They found themselves reluctantly yet spontaneously answering the questions he put to them. "When the Lord of the vineyard cometh, what will he do unto these husbandmen?" Their answer came, "He will miserably destroy those wicked men, and will let out his vineyard unto other husbandmen, which shall render him the fruits of their seasons." Without hesitation, Jesus brought home the indictment with deadly precision, leaving them condemned by their own judgment. "Therefore I say unto you, the kingdom of God shall be taken from you and given to a nation bringing forth the fruits thereof." Not since the prophet Nathan had pointed an accusing finger at David, condemning him with the dramatic revelation, "Thou art the man," had ministers so nakedly self-confessed that did these rulers of Israel in the temple on this third morning of the Passover week. Unhappily, they had none of the humility and contrition of David, and their reaction was in its way as characteristic as his. They sought to lay hands on him, but feared the people. It was open warfare now. There could be no retreat. It had to be fought out until victory was achieved by one side or the other. So far, there could be no doubt which way the battle swayed. The spears of the priests buckled against the breastplate of righteousness. Their duplicity was no match for his simple honesty. He no longer withstood their onslaught. He carried the war relentlessly into their own camp. The time of pleading was over. Now he exposed them before all the people, laying bare the poverty and iniquity that lay beneath those bright robes and pious practices. He told them another parable. The king made a great marriage feast for his son and sent his servants to call the guests. But those who had been invited made light of it and would not come. Not only did they insult the king by casting his favours back in his face, but they maltreated those whom he sent to remind them of their privilege. As Jesus spoke, we imagine the vision of Jerusalem appearing once more before his eyes. When the king heard thereof, he was wroth, and he sent forth his army and destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. But the king's son will have his wedding. Other guests will sit at the table and enjoy the feast. The servants went into the highways to bid them to come. Their poverty, their toil-stained clothes, their ignorance of courtly ways matter not one whit, for they will be washed, and the king will furnish them with robes. Yet this gracious invitation must not be lightly esteemed, and one who spurns to wear the wedding garment will enjoy neither the riches of the banquet nor the fellowship of the king's son, but will be cast into outer darkness. For, concluded Jesus in words which rebuke any facile optimism, many are called, but few are chosen. The first phase of the battle was over. The attempt to break Christ's hold over the people had proved an abysmal failure, which had ended in their own disgrace. The Pharisees looked significantly at one another, and then slowly withdrew to consider how they might change the direction of their attack and gain their end by entangling him in his speech.